This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, you'll get a fresh update on Japan after the tsunami and nuclear accident. Is it a chance to build new green cities, or a vision of what we all face as the oil runs out? Then a quick interview with anti-nuclear campaigner Helen Caldicott at the Occupy the EPA protest in Washington, followed by an invitation by Susan Moser to get real about our difficult future as we destabilize the climate. There's no time to waste. Do you worry about an energy shortage, a nuclear accident, or a severe economic hit? Welcome to Japan, which is dealing with all three following the deadly tsunami and nuclear accident in March 2011. We have a new report from Warren Karlenzig, who just toured Japan with the United Nations Group. As the founder of Common Current, Warren advises city and national governments on sustainability. He's a fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute. In 2009, Radio EcoShock broadcast Warren's speech at a Vancouver panel. Warren, why did you go to Japan?
Well, I was invited by the United Nations Center for Regional Development, which I have worked with in the past, to train mayors from around Asia on sustainable urban planning. And they were in conversations with the Japan Ministry of Foreign Affairs to bring in outside experts to advise the nation on potential redevelopment strategies for the areas impacted by the tsunami and the Fukushima nuclear accident.
Well, we can't get to the impact of that nuclear accident or Japan's exciting prospects for green energy without first giving respect to the people who live with the tragic loss of more than 20,000 lives, of whole towns and a large part of the country. What's your feeling of how people in Japan are coping with that unimaginable stress?
Well, one thing they're trying to do is just to be engaged, with rebuild their own personal lives, to try to get a temporary shelter. There are now over 300,000 people in Japan living in temporary shelters, and they're also trying to figure out how to bring back their economy or to salvage what they had left of their old economy, and just to keep their spirits up and to keep fighting, because the survivors feel that, you know, they're lucky to have survived such a disaster, and so that, you know, they kind of need to take that and move it forward into the future. So that's really kind of the attitude we met with there. And it was a lot more uplifting than I expected.
And thinking about how we survive large-scale disasters, how much help would you say comes from the government and how much from self-organization by the citizens?
Well, in Japan, it seems that you know, a certain amount comes from the national government, the prefecture-level governments, which are equivalent to our states in the United States or territories in Canada. And the international community was very quick to respond with a lot of aid. You know, we heard some fascinating stories how the U.S. military, for instance, in their boats offshore of Japan, came into some of these towns and were some of the first responders to dig people out or try to rescue people. Also, international organizations, a whole range of, there are 450 non-governmental organizations involved in the tsunami-impacted region alone that are lending assistance, mostly on a community-by-community basis. So it's largely unorchestrated at a high level, and they're just going in and doing what they can to clean up the muck, the debris, to get people, you know, back on their feet again.
And one of the hot-button issues in Japan is the national government's plan to redistribute tsunami wreckage, including some material contaminated with radioactive waste, all over the country. What did you hear about that?
Well, we heard bits and pieces, and we witnessed some of the radioactive material. For instance, some of the soil or other debris that was deemed to be radioactive was stored in large bags or sacks or fabric. And some of these were right next to high schools or schools or right in the center of some of these disaster-impacted communities. Other things we witnessed was soil, that they're taking up the soil in some of the agricultural areas, which are spread throughout the region, and moving it in large piles. And some of the farmer we met with that was doing that on their small organic farm, they were under the impression that the national government would take away that soil once they had done that. but that is not the case so far. So there's a lot of confusion as to how to determine how radioactive the soil is, besides using your own instrumentation for farmers and other people in towns. And then the other debris, you know, some of it in piles that are 100 meters high, or, you know, almost 100 meters high, of just the most intense mixture of materials and former houses and wood and soil and chemicals. So it's quite a mess. And really, I didn't see any sort of clear pathway to resolution.
And with almost all the nuclear reactors out of service, how are the Japanese substituting or dealing with their lack of energy?
Right. Yeah, they shut down today, the second to the last one out of 54, and the last one is scheduled to go down next month. Well, there's no clear solution there, except people are conserving more than they ever have, and it's a national concerted effort and community-based effort to not use lights during the day, use passive daylighting. You know, so you walk in a building, a government building or other buildings, and they're very dim. You know, this was during the winter we were there, and they don't use indoor lights except a few emergency lights. They don't use heat in a lot of the buildings now in the disaster area. So, you know, people wear jackets and hats and scarves. It's, you know, anywhere from, you know, 5 below Celsius to about 0 Celsius or maybe 1 or 2 degrees. You know, it's quite cold in these buildings, and people are making do by bundling up, and then in the rooms where they have meetings and get together and convene, they'll have a kerosene heater or two to heat things up a little more to make it tolerable. And then finally, we saw a lot of people drying their clothes in their windows, in the south-facing windows, and I think that's, you know, a traditional practice in parts of Japan, but we saw it even in Tokyo in the northern suburbs on a large scale, going past, you know, relatively prosperous apartment buildings and people with all their clothes out on the balcony or in the windows. And this summer is going to be the real test, because last summer they were about 25% below their production level of their baseline energy, and now they're going to be about 33% below as all the nuclear reactors go offline. So this summer will really tell how they're doing. They also have an online method. People can go on to the internet and log in and see what demand is going to be like for the day and where the peak hours are going to be. And they've been very good about not using appliances, heat, light, fans, et cetera, air conditioners during those hours when possible.
Well, this sounds like something we could all do. Do you think this sudden failure of energy supplies is comparable to a peak oil shock?
Oh, yes. It's definitely a view into, you know, our collective future globally, what some of our nations or regions or cities will be facing. And, you know, it's just the question of how it will come and what the combination of the shocks will be. Will it come to transportation? Will it come to stationary power sources? Will it come to food or our supply chains? And, you know, the answer is probably all of the above, but we can't tell what the combinations will be when the problems will first arise. So this is really a textbook example of an industrialized country that's facing something similar to peak oil, to what we will be living through in our future. We don't know when it's going to be exactly, but in terms of our civilization and how it adapts.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Warren Karlenzig. You can follow Warren at commoncurrent.com. Warren, is there an opportunity in Japan to rebuild new green cities and towns?
Yes, absolutely. And that, Alex, was one of the reasons why I was there. And I've worked around the world on sustainable urban planning and green economic development. And I think the Japanese just wanted an outside view of what some possibilities are. The Japanese are fairly advanced in terms of their green technologies. The question is, you know, how can they apply it at such a large scale in planning communities, in planning infrastructure, in planning technologies, behaviors, citizen actions, government actions, and that the jury is still out, whether they're able to execute the way they will need to in the face of this tragedy. So I think they're just looking for all hands on deck in terms of expertise from the outside. There were a couple other, one other American with me, and other folks from Thailand, from Bangladesh, from Australia that were also along on the tour to advise on waste management and how, for instance, some of the waste from the tsunami can be turned into potential energy sources for biomass or biofuels and things of that nature.
And in your blog, you wrote that two cities have proposed smart growth models, and one is even seeking a sort of zero emissions process. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, there are a couple cities in the tsunami damaged region, and there are different plans being bandied about for either eco towns or future cities, they're calling them. One is Rakuza Tanaka, which is one city that was really badly damaged by the tsunami, almost virtually wiped out. They are looking at having distributed energy power their city almost exclusively. The question is, you know, how they will do that, what the plan will be, what forms of energy they will use, what the mix will be of, for instance, solar or biomass or hydro, small-scale hydro, et cetera. And a number of cities besides that city or town are also looking at smart growth, you know, building much denser, building town centers where they were a little more sprawled out before, because those will be more defensible against tsunamis also if they build on higher ground away from the flood-prone areas and they have more focused development. It's easier to manage in terms of a disaster, in terms of preparation, in terms of building and planning, and it's more efficient with infrastructure, too. So there was Ofunato City is planning on more of a smart growth, but also possibly a distributed energy development scenario.
And you write that some of the barriers to smart growth are social. Tell us about the age problem and the role of women in revisioning the New Japan.
Well, traditionally, Japan has been a patriarchal society. You know, some of the meetings we went to in some of the towns, and we met with about five disaster-impacted towns in the tsunami region, two in the nuclear radiation-impacted region, more heavily impacted. And, you know, one of the towns had 15 men we were meeting with, officials, and there were no women represented or, you know, really no one representing elderly or the very young or, you know, any of the other groups of people that have a right to and have a need to express how their new city or their new town should be designed. That was illuminating. I think that, you know, there's just a need for them to include far more groups of people in their planning instead of just having it taken care of by a few city officials. You know, it seems to be the Japanese way more to have society all supposedly band together in a common interest and with a common goal. But in this case, I don't know if they're really banding together across all diverse areas of their society effectively. We'll need to do that to come back. Otherwise, people will not feel that their villages or their towns or their cities are being designed or planned or at least capturing input from everyone.
And the Japanese society is already aging, and yet some of the young people are just plain leaving this area and going somewhere else. Is that the story?
That is the story, and that has been the story in Japan for a number of years. A lot of the towns to the north are thought to be fairly traditional and old-fashioned even by the young people, and there aren't many new jobs. You know, they relied a lot on fisheries and on agriculture, small-scale agriculture, which are, you know, some of that's very popular now in North America, for instance, the small-scale ag with young people, but in Japan, not so much. And so they're going to the city, to Tokyo or other cities, Osaka, for, you know, different careers, professional careers, and they're leaving the towns behind to the older people. Now, the tsunami just made that worse. It came in and then the ravaged everything, and people thought, wow, it was already a dying city. So, you know, there's talk of some of the towns or cities there being ghost towns or ghost cities. They're really at a crossroads as to how they will deal with their changing demographics, as something like 40% of their population will be over 65 in the future, I think a decade or two decades or three decades from now. So it's getting even worse than it is now in terms of being just an elderly society.
And the other thing that puzzled me is, 1 year after, why has reconstruction not already begun?
Well, one major impediment to that is the subsidence of the ground, that the ground is still sinking in many of these areas impacted by the earthquake. This was the fourth most powerful earthquake in history of our modern civilization of Earth, and it was a fault where one plate, which Japan is on, went underneath the plate that's out in the ocean, and therefore it sunk during the event, during the earthquake of March 11, 2011, but also it continues to sink. So there are areas where it's sinking 1, 2, 3, 4 feet since the earthquake, and it has not ceased. So they can't even begin to do reconstruction planning on some of those impacted areas until that stops and at least stabilizes and you know, gets maybe sinking an inch or, you know, a millimeter, a couple of millimeters a year rather than a foot or two.
That is just amazing. The ground sinking so far, it's hard for us to imagine. Warren Karlenzig, you have talked about rumors, I would call them at this point, of a switch to renewables in Japan. Is there a difference in the views of local citizens, of local governments, and the national government? Did you get any feel for how that works?
Well, we had very few conversations at the national level. We did meet the Minister of Foreign Affairs, which is the equivalent of Secretary of State, for instance, in the United States. And we didn't have an extended conversation with him, but we did talk more with some of the local leaders in the cities and also a governor, the Fukushima prefecture. And the governors, especially the Fukushima prefecture, are opposed to nuclear power in the future. And that decision has really stood above all else in making nuclear a thing of the past in Japan, it seems. They are not going to be able to restart a number of those reactors, even if they are deemed to be safe, until they get the go-ahead from local officials. And the local officials have just seen their economies ravaged in many ways. You know, all the agricultural produce is suspect or contaminated. You know, the industries are shut down. They don't know what to do about their supply chains. You know, people can't live there. It's quite a mess, a wicked problem, a lot of people would call it. They're tangled up problems that there's no clear way to untangle them even. You know, that's some of the sentiment we heard.
And Warren, with your expertise in sustainable city design, you went to Japan as part of a multinational UN team. What do you see as the real next steps in the Japanese recovery?
Well, I outlined recommendations to the United Nations Center for Regional Development and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And the main recommendations were, number one, is to get the community involved as much as possible right now in reconstruction planning. And don't make it just something that, you know, the officials only are involved in. You know, get everyone involved. Get centers where people can go and see what kind of progress is being made, and look at photos, and look at drawings, and look at models, and just discuss these things and argue them if possible, because that makes for a much healthier plan, is to have a lot of input in and a lot of thought, and sometimes a lot of friction even. So that was number one. The other recommendations were around the green economy, really just to have a more transparent process as to what they're considering. I mean, we heard, I don't know if they're rumors or what, but some of it was, you know, officials saying they want to have renewable energy and they're planning on it, but I did not have access to some of those plans. I saw some of the, you know, the land use plans in Japanese, but they didn't have, even when I got translations, they didn't have much about the renewable energy, just maybe a paragraph or two here or there. They need to do real planning in terms of like a roadmap, a phased strategy, exactly how much renewable energy they're going to use in their economy and how they're going to phase it in, what they're going to phase out, and what it's going to look like in terms of infrastructure, in terms of what types of renewable energy, what types of buildings. You know, super efficient green buildings would be the call, obviously, but no one was even talking about green buildings, really, in our discussions with the local leaders. And, of course, it's early stage now. This is a 5 to 10 year rebuilding process, but they really need to have these conversations and a lot of the scientific analysis and economic analysis going right now, looking at, you know, for instance, how the green economy does better than the conventional economy. Studies like in California showing that, you know, it's like twice the amount of growth over 10 years or so. and what that would mean in Japan. I mean, they have the perfect opportunity. They have really a devastated area that needs to be rebuilt completely, and that is where you can gain the most efficiency out of systems that use water efficiently, use energy efficiently, use renewables, develop local food production or local supply chains when possible, and bring jobs to the region based on all these new industries, because that's really the 21st century story of growth.
Are there personal experiences that struck you on this trip?
Well, one thing was the food situation. You know, when we started our trip in the far north of the tsunami-damaged region, Iwate province, and you know, I was a little wary of some of the food being contaminated or potentially contaminated, and wanted to reduce my exposure. And we didn't hear about it at first in the first village or two, and then suddenly we heard that the mushrooms were contaminated in the town we were in. Well, actually, the official said there was rumors of contamination at first, and when we pressed them, they said there was contamination, and it was twice the level that the national government had set. Now, mushrooms are just a staple food in Japan, and they're produced locally almost everywhere you go in many types, and it's a type of food I love. So, I was torn between wanting to support them in the region and wanting to maintain my health. And then as we've traveled further south into the closer to the Fukushima plant, there was more contamination, and the soil was heavily contaminated in some areas, and they were having to remove it, or they weren't, they were left to their own devices. And so, we had one lunch of all organic local food served by in someone's home, and typically this would be, one of the highlights of my travels of somewhere to Japan or wherever. And in this case, there was anxiety, I think, on my part, because I didn't want to eat some of the food, especially the rice that is, some of that, I believe, got on the market that could be contaminated, the mushrooms, the seafood, that comes from the local area. The greens in particular, leafy greens, are thought to really capture a lot of the radioactive fallout. So it really changed my experience. And, if you can't eat healthy food or potentially drink healthy water, everything else really comes into question as to how healthy and what the prospects for our society are.
And as we finish up, is there anything you'd like to add for our listeners?
I'm hopeful about Japan, and I do want to return there. And I do think that people around the world should support Japan in whatever way they can, and that includes visiting Japan. Now, I've visited also further south in Japan last year, and I really thought the danger of radiation is very low in anywhere south of Tokyo, especially if you get down to Osaka or Kyoto, really very little danger. In Tokyo now, I think the danger is very reduced. The one danger is some of the food is being circulated around the country that could have some radiation in it and might have health impacts eventually for some people. That people can judge on their own. But I think we need to support Japan and even tour the tsunami-damaged region if possible, just to show people that the international community cares and that we want to support them, just as we would need this kind of support if this happened in our own backyard. It would be very important to get other people to come and to speak with them and to share the experience and to work on potential solutions. That's what we all need to do together.
You have been listening to Sustainable Cities expert Warren Karlenzig. Keep track of Warren at commoncurrent.com. Warren, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, Alex. I really enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We go now to Jerry Williams, our Washington correspondent.
I'm here with physician and anti-nuclear champion Dr. Helen Caldicott, who is in Washington on March 30th for the Occupy EPA action at the EPA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Dr. Caldicott, why are we still talking about nuclear power and nuclear weapons? It's been decades. We've had a movement to do away with weapons. Now it seems as if acceptance of nuclear power is creeping back into the conversation, the nuclear renaissance. in face of what just happened a mere year ago at Fukushima, why are we still accepting nuclear power?
I don't think people are accepting it now after Fukushima. In fact, I saw a poll yesterday in the New York Times to say that about 60% of Americans now are cautious and wary and concerned about nuclear power. That's post-Fukushima, which shows that the nuclear industry have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in the past few years saying that they're the answer to global warming, even though they cause global warming in their own right because they're undergirded by huge industrial infrastructure, mining, milling, enriching uranium, building reactors, produce a huge amount of CO2 and global warming gases. So they advertise in Scientific American, on NPR, all over the place, which was really wicked. I rang NPR and said, why are you taking these ads from the nuclear energy industry? And they couldn't really answer me. Money. Underwriting, they call it, but it's advertising. But now the Fukushima accident, I predict, will lead to the end of nuclear power, not just in Japan, Germany, Italy, Switzerland, Belgium, which have all said no, but China, America. And also, you know, it's not if but when you have a meltdown. And I tell you, when Americans dying are dying of acute radiation illness and leukemia, that's it. So it hasn't hit you yet. Do you have to wait till it hits you before you develop some common sense and do the right thing?
Yeah, I wonder about that because, on the other hand, even though we're facing, you know, peak oil and energy challenges, we're being told that we have to have nuclear because the oil is running out.
That's rhubarb.
And that there's a whole new safer generation of nuclear facilities.
Those two statements are lies. You use oil for transportation, not to generate electricity. One, and two, the new reactors are much, much more dangerous by orders of magnitude than the present light water reactors because they're fueled with plutonium, where 1/1,000,000th of a gram is a carcinogen. They're cooled by liquid sodium, which explodes when exposed to air. So if you get a hole in a pipe, you get a meltdown. And 5 kilos or 10 pounds of plutonium is critical mass. So if you've got 100 tons of plutonium in a reactor and you lose the coolant and there's a meltdown and you get 10 pounds of plutonium together, you get critical mass and a massive nuclear explosion scattering, you know, tons and tons of plutonium to the four winds, which is the most ghastly, hideous machine I could ever imagine. They're the new safe reactors.
And let me ask you, too, about something that you'd mentioned before, just the entrenched power of money and where we are in this country in dealing with the influence of money in politics.
Yeah. You know, I said today in my speech that Congress is full of corporate prostitutes. I mean, what else can you say? They are. And even Obama's a corporate prostitute. Until you get that blasted corporate money out of politics, the politicians will do whatever the corporations want, and to hell with the people, to hell with their health and well-being, to hell with what 99% want. So therefore, we need a revolution. We need a peaceful, sagacious, quiet revolution led by knowledge and education, like the one we had in the 80s, where we educated the majority of Americans to know nuclear war was bad for their health. And in 5 years, and I helped to lead that movement with my fellow physicians, from most people supporting the concept of nuclear war, better dead than red, in 5 years, 80% opposed nuclear war. And so therefore, that was the second American Revolution. Let's do it again. But we've got to educate ourselves. We've got to get away from our Facebook pages. We've got to get out in the streets. We've got to read books. And I suggest my books humbly.
What's your latest book is titled?
Well, there are a few, actually. Nuclear power is not the answer. If you love this planet, war in heaven, and loving this planet. And you'll find them all on my webpage.
One last thing. You've mentioned, every time I've heard you talk or seen your speeches, yeah, you always mention the children because of the future and because they are so vulnerable.
And I'm a pediatrician.
And you're a pediatrician.
So I'm practicing global preventive medicine.
What kinds of things do we need to do to educate children and really capture their imagination?
I don't think that's fair to tell the children how we've screwed up the world. That's cruel. We've done it. We're their parents and grandparents. It's up to us to fix the world for them and make it safe and give them an innocent, delightful childhood.
What keeps you going, Dr. Caldicott?
I have this crazy notion that I can do some good. And, you know, miracles do occur. You never know what's going to happen. I mean, we did end the Cold War, that's true. And I think after the Cold War ended, everyone thought, thank God it's over, but it wasn't. And Clinton left the weapons in place. And if we're blown up tonight in a nuclear holocaust, that's Clinton's legacy. And for that, I resent him enormously.
I was involved in the nuclear freeze, and we educated ourselves to talk about throw weights and
yeah.
things like that, that
yep.
you know, so we could speak
yep.
knowledgeably,
yeah.
and that seems to just have
we've
gone
got, no,
water
we've
under
got
the bridge.
To, we've got to do it again, and I've started playing my film called If You Love This Planet, which is banned by the Justice Department as foreign propaganda. I gave a speech in Plattsburgh, New York. The Canadian Film Board made the film. It won an Oscar in Hollywood. The U.S. Justice Department banned it as foreign propaganda under, I think, an old 1948 law that bans communist propaganda or some rot. And so it's virtually never been played here, and it really busts people's psychic numbing apart. It's only half an hour long. So get the film from the National Film Board of Canada and play it everywhere. And if they come to me, the Justice Department, or they arrest me, well, then I might get on Rush Limbaugh, and I might get on Fox, and I might, you know... Then you can talk about the fact that the haircuts are old-fashioned 20 years ago or 30 years ago, but the film is still totally relevant because we could be blown up tonight and the medical data is still the same.
Thank you so much.
Oh, good.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
I'm speaking with Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo, one of the co-organizers of the Occupy EPA March that is going to be taking place. Doctor, could you tell me about your motivation for this march, the reason behind it, and what you hope to accomplish?
I think it's incumbent upon our entire community to really start fighting for an environment that's healthy and not an environment, particularly an EPA, that's not controlled by corporations. I mean, one of the problems that we have in our community is that the EPA is not taking care of its business. It's important for African Americans and people of color to become involved with the environmental movement. We are really the first victims of environmental injustice. Our homes are sited closer to environmental facilities than any other homes. Our children are more likely to have lead poisoning or neurotoxic levels of lead in their brain. Our children are more likely to have learning disabilities. Breast cancer in African American women tend to be a bit more stubborn than in Caucasian women. So we are really the first victims of environmental injustice, and it is so important that we become involved. Recently, a report was issued by Deloitte, a consulting firm, that said it takes EPA 15 years to handle a Title VI complaint. Now, a Title VI complaint is a complaint by a community about a facility in their community. 15 years is a lifetime in the history of a family, which means that the agency has turned its back on communities of color that are suffering under the weight of industrialization. So we have decided to say enough is enough, and that we are going to fight for our families and fight for our communities, fight for our health. And as far as we're concerned, this administration has really not heard the voice of the people yet on this issue.
Radio EcoShock.
Let's get real about our situation. As David Orr put it, this is not the time for illusion or evasion. It is time for transformation. I'm Alex Smith. We're going to talk about an article, part of an upcoming book. The title is Getting Real About It, Meeting the Psychological and Social Demands of a World in Distress. Our guest is the author, Dr. Suzanne C. Moser. She is a researcher and consultant from California, associated with Stanford University. Suzanne was previously a scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Suzanne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
I've really looked forward to our talk ever since I read your refreshing look at where we really are. I'm going to ask you a few impossibly difficult questions, but only because you were brave enough to raise them. Now, before we get to your prescriptions for living in what I would call a sick civilization, You pick out one particular illness as a case study. We could be talking about mass extinctions or running out of fresh water, but you chose the problem of climate change as your example. Do you want to take a few minutes, if you like, and tell us why and where you think we really stand with the climate?
Well, I chose climate change in large part because I've been working on it for the last 15, 20 years, so it's sort of an obvious choice to speak about something that I know a little bit more about than some other things. Having said that, some of the other challenges, global challenges that you mentioned are, of course, not happening sort of separately from climate change, but they will interact with it, which, in fact, in my view, makes it more likely that we will see tipping points or that we will see big challenges for society and for our environment a lot sooner, simply because they will interact. And, you know, that's at least the history of the past 20 years or so of climate change predictions, that most things actually occur a lot sooner than we thought because of the interactions in the climate system, in the Earth system. So that's the big reason why I chose climate change. It's, of course, also one of the most urgent issues that I, in my view, that humanity faces. Where are we? Well, if you look at the science, basically every piece of new news is essentially bad news, telling us, as I just mentioned, that things are occurring faster than we thought they might occur, and giving us a pretty clear understanding that if we wanted to change directions, i.e. really radically reduce our emissions, we better get on the job yesterday. And because we have delayed action for so long, the longer we continue to wait, the more expensive it gets. And so given, you know, we're in a recession, given that society never likes to spend very much on issues right now but always postpones till later, we're in a predicament of letting this problem get worse and worse and more expensive as a result of it.
And there are scientists, serious scientists, even conferences, talking about going beyond 4 degrees.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. There was a conference a few years ago at Oxford that was probably the first of these that sort of really put the notion of going beyond 4 degrees Celsius on the docket. You know, there's sort of this very strange fixation on 2 degrees or on doubling of CO2, sort of maybe just because it's simpler to grasp. It's something that we can, that looks small, that, you know, we can still handle. And what's really interesting about this is that we actually have very little science that tells us how the world will do in a 4 degree, 5 degree, 6 degree kind of situation. And that's average, global average temperature increases. So it's a world of much greater extremes and of serious threat to the life support system that certainly we depend on, but many other species as well.
So it's kind of a disruption that we're hurtling towards, completely unknown lives, you could say, in a climate we've never seen. And you suggest there are two roads ahead. There are, you call them, two kinds of transitions. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, sometimes I call them the two difficulties, actually, because both will be difficult ones. The one possibility is that we basically continue with business as usual as we currently do, and there are many indications that, you know, we seem to be headed that way. It's certainly not the only option, and we may change course, but basically we will just continue to postpone, we will continue to emit, we will continue to develop fossil fuels. And so we reach these 4, 5, 6 degree warming scenarios very rapidly. And the sort of, you know, implications of that is exactly what I just described earlier. That is disruption of life support systems, extinction of species, huge diminishment of all the things that we critically depend on, like water, the sea level rise, wiping out coastal areas, and things like that. So that one is a scenario, in my mind, of great disruption, great disasters, catastrophic impacts, probably huge amounts of species loss, including a huge amount of human life loss in that scenario. But we're not bound to have to do that. And so I want to make very clear, we have another choice. And the other choice might be that we somehow accept what a radically difficult life that first scenario might be, and that we will put everything, and I mean everything, into reducing our emissions and dealing with, preparing for and dealing with those impacts that we can't avoid, because there is, of course, a long lag system, both in the human systems, but also in the climate system. And so that scenario will be marked by tremendous changes. I mean, if we are serious about getting from where we are today to a 80%, 90%, 100% reduction of CO2 emissions, that will completely change our lives. It may be a much better life than we have. There will be many benefits to that, co-benefits regarding air pollution and whatnot. But it is a life of tremendous change, and that means we have to lose something. We have to let go of what we have right now, all the the particular comforts, the particular things we're used to. Doesn't mean that that future isn't a fine one. It just simply means there's going to be a tremendous amount of change. So one is change because of catastrophic impact. The other one is change because we will have made all these changes in our environment. And because of the lags in the climate system, we still will see some impacts, though much less, from climate change and other interacting stressors. So those are my two difficult world visions, if you will, with everything in between.
And, you know, there's a little voice inside me going, well, okay, anything, but I'm not giving up my trip to Disney World. You know, we have this unreal separation between where we are now and the places that we need to go. So in a minute, we're going to talk about your next step, the core of your article, Getting Real About It. But first, I hit a stumbling block. You write about, and apparently for, environmental leaders. And give me a second on this. I wonder if there are any. I see environmentalists who are more or less powerless in the current political economy. I see leaders who are mostly bought, it seems, by big fossil fuel companies and other corporate interests. An environmental leader sounds like a hybrid that doesn't exist yet. Who are you talking about?
Well, it's an interesting question that has a flip and a much more sophisticated answer. The flip answer is I was asked to write a handbook for environmental leadership that is oriented toward actually young people who are choosing by way of their studies or whatever they may do to choose to become leaders in the environmental arena. So that course of action, if you will, typically means expertise in an environmental field, and maybe being a good organizer and maybe, you know, having some political savvy. And the purpose for writing my chapter was to say, well, and then you need some other skills, and we'll come back to that in a minute. So that's the flip answer, you know, who this is simply writing toward. The more sophisticated answer is that I actually believe you can be an environmental leader in your family. You can be simply a mature adult in your community, in wherever you are, in your company. And there have been some. That doesn't mean that those leaders fix the problem for us. That's, I think, a notion of leadership that I don't ascribe to, and also a leadership model that maybe is a little bit outdated in the world that we're going to. There's going to be change and things to deal with wherever we are. This is the nature of a global problem like this. And so leaders will be required everywhere. Whether or not they come to positions of power where they can change the course. I mean, yes, it would be great if it was also speaking to, you know, the Obamas of the world or whatever the other leaders, premiers and whatnot of the world. But this is a book and a really, for me, a chapter oriented toward anyone who would take on the difficult work in the world that we're facing.
All right, well, let's imagine that whole populations finally realize we are in a biosphere on life support, and they elect leaders to save us from more losses, if not extinction. You say any new system will have to live through, and I quote, enormous losses, human distress, constant crisis, and the seemingly endless need to remain engaged in the task of maintaining, restoring, and rebuilding, despite all the setbacks, a viable planet. Suzanne, do we have to imagine this as a future, or are we already there?
Well, it's probably not as dire as some of what I envision it will be when the world has warmed, you know, 2, 3, 4 more degrees than it already has. So I think we're beginning to see the starts of it, and certainly in countries and communities that are much closer to the bottom line than some of us who are still very privileged, I would think that for them this is a much more real scenario already. And I think we actually can learn quite a bit from that. These days, I like to look to Greece and look at austerity measures and, you know, the street riots that you get in response. That sort of, I mean, that basically Greece has lost 6% of GDP in the last couple of years. And that's kind of the scenario that one would envision if you radically put your money into reducing emissions and preparing for the impact. So that's the kind of scale of challenge that we might face, not endlessly, but, you know, that might be one that we might face for a decade or so before we had really made the shift to a no-carbon economy, essentially. I think this is, you know, something that will become much more prevalent in the future, and it is a scenario I think that's difficult to look straight in the eye and keep really focused on.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Suzanne Moser. We are discussing a draft of her contribution to the upcoming SAGE Reference Handbook of Environmental Leadership. I think her article is important for all of us, and that's why we're talking about it. Suzanne, you have some great quotes all through your article. Let's move to the next one. As Bill McKibben says, we must accept the fact that the world we have known is going to change in hideous and damaging ways. You call this the first and bravest step. Why is that?
Well, I think it actually is a really brave, courageous, and difficult thing to do, to look at the magnitude of change, the profundity of change that we as a human species have, you know, perpetrated on this planet. I mean, there is a reason why geologists are beginning to think about this time not as the Holocene, but as the Anthropocene, as the period or the era geologically where the largest force shaping the future of the planet is the human species. Letting that sink in and letting sink in that we are looking at a really difficult future, I find that that's hard. It's taken me years. I tell the story in here of a friend of mine who is a coral researcher and has been doing that work for decades. And basically, one day, it occurred to her what it would mean to live in a world without coral, something that she's very passionate about and creatures that she loves. And it made her just, you know, run to the bathroom and throw up. I mean, it's that difficult to come to grips with what it means to have caused such disruption, such losses, such extinctions, and difficulties for our own species.
It seems, though, to me like our current leaders, even if they made green promises, they're talking about growing through a magical world of a great metropolis with a wonderful new technology, sort of like the 1960s, only better. And when it doesn't turn out that way, whoever enters leadership has to confront perhaps waves of popular distress and anger, as you mentioned happened in Greece. How are they going to do it?
Well, that's a very good question. I think, you know, I sort of look to the past, to some of the leaders that, you know, the UK, the US has seen, who basically, if you think of Churchill, who had really nothing to offer but sweat, toil, and blood, you know, who were willing to say it will take the ultimate sacrifice to turn a very grave situation around. In an electoral system where, you know, you depend on everybody being happy 4 years from now, that's a very difficult proposition. So, you know, in some ways, I actually have very little hope at the moment that this is coming, certainly not in the United States from the top elected leaders, but that this kind of leadership is coming from the grassroots up that will make it impossible for the top leaders to continue to be as oblivious and as irresponsible, quite frankly, as they currently are.
And then, Suzanne Moser, you hit another really important target. Once people realize a couple of generations have ruined the known natural world, what the heck are we going to do with all that blame? Do we hang a bunch of geriatric climate criminals, or do we declare an amnesty, or what?
Yeah, that's an interesting piece in my chapter where I really talk about holding this paradox of, on the one hand, we need to be accountable. We ourselves, as much as other people, need to be accountable for what we have done. And at the same time, we also need to find a way to give amnesty to people. And I'll tell you from a very real example of how I got to this particular issue. I mean, one of them, for example, is that in the name of climate change, I and many, you know, travel the world to basically, in inverted commas, to save the world, right? We're all implicated. Every time you drive somewhere, you're implicated in contributing your bit to causing this problem. So that's one big problem, that we're all actually, if you look in the mirror, you look at the person who has perpetrated or contributed to this problem. So that's one issue. The second one comes from a bit of research that I've done here in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I interviewed people about how do we move forward with adaptation, with dealing with the impacts of climate change. And one of the things that we were talking about at that stage in the interview was how difficult it is to move forward because certain business interests, development interests, you know, are simply not ready to sign on to doing something, or maybe retreating from their claim on the development pie, if you will. And one of the things that this interviewee was saying is, you know, there are people who for all their professional lives have made decisions that now turn out to put people at risk, say at risk from flooding or something, by building in a floodplain or in an area that previously wasn't even a floodplain but will become one because of sea level rise. And he said, you know, so what do you think? Is that person just going to come around and admit that he made his entire life mistakes like that? No. I mean, that would be very difficult for any one of us to do, to admit that for our entire lives we have made the exactly wrong decisions. I mean, you know, our egos are attached to this, our sense of pride, our sense of self so often is tied up in how we conduct ourselves and what we do for work. So I think we need to find ways in which we can speak to and address the fact that, or make it possible for people to come back, if you will. Make it possible for people to make that admission and turn around and change their ways of doing business. And that, to me, is this notion of amnesty. We need to find ways of bringing people back onto a different way of doing business, or else they will just deny the issue. They will just, you know, persist and resist what needs to happen.
And then I wonder if we go into what James Howard Kunstler has called the long emergency, I worry we'll go into a great leader syndrome and accept something like a police state or even a violent state as alleged solutions to these really big problems. Do you think that can work, or can we even avoid that?
It's a very big question. You know, in a place or in a situation where we have really let go of a very actively engaged democracy, the slide into that sort of situation is, it's not hard to imagine how that could happen. I think there's a really wonderful book that I just finished reading by Parker Palmer called Healing the Heart of Democracy, in which he really speaks to exactly how we actually need to reinvigorate and live back in a much more democratically engaged society. And he has very concrete suggestions that sort of are the, you know, extended versions of my 7 steps there in my chapter of what we need to do to be able to speak to people who are other, who are different, and to bring us together and to make these decisions swiftly, but also, you know, accept that we need to move forward and we can't be stuck in endless debates and blaming each other. That will guarantee that we move nowhere.
If you've just tuned in, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are getting real about it with author Suzanne Moser. In the end, we return to your initial project to imagine what qualifies a necessary environmental leader would need. You suggest monster challenges, whether it's climate change or other things like dying oceans. These big problems need leaders who will grow themselves up, you say. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think about some of the things that I suggest in this chapter in terms of the challenges that or the qualities, if you will, that leaders have to have, you know, things like facing the truth, being able to be with your own grief, but also helping that, you know, others be in their grief and in their distress, growing the ability to hold paradoxes, somehow figuring out this very murky moral territory of, you know, how do we hold ourselves accountable and also give amnesty to people, and then how are we nonviolent both to humans and to the rest of the environment and the earth and restore our life system. You know, take these together. To me, these are qualities of someone who is essentially a mature person. You might almost use the word an elder, someone who has really a wisdom far beyond what most people currently exhibit in their daily lives. And so to me, this is the work of actually becoming psychologically mature, to develop into mature beings. That's what I mean by growing ourselves up. We don't have anyone who will do it for us, so we have to do it ourselves.
So beyond this article, what are you working on or researching now?
This particular challenge here that I'm laying out, I continue that in work that I do with my partner that is focused on the next bit of our focus really is on how do we address these issues in a highly polarized environment. At least here in the U.S., it's almost impossible to have a reasonable conversation about climate change. So we're trying to make some progress on that. In my research, I focus on notions of adaptation success, which is kind of related to this in some ways, in that we have some really, really tough choices to make, and not just on mitigation side of climate change, but also with the adaptation side. And say in the coastal arena where sea level is rising and will continue to rise for hundreds and thousands of years, we will lose something. We will not be able to hold on. So how do we even move in that direction? How do we handle that situation? And so I'm trying to make some progress in that. I'm very involved with the National Climate Assessment here in the U.S. in trying to make clear what is the latest state of affairs and how serious the situation is. So just a lot of work related to communication and adaptation to climate change, and continuing this sort of challenge here of how do we engage and get people to get real about it. I guess that's the ultimate goal.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. You've been listening to Dr. Suzanne C. Moser. We've been talking about her contribution to the upcoming book, The SAGE Reference Handbook of Environmental Leadership. Suzanne has been a scientist for NOAA and with the Union of Concerned Scientists. She currently has her own research and consulting company in California. Find links to Suzanne's original article in my blog at ecoshock.info, or just Google the title, Getting Real About It, Meeting the Psychological and Social Demands of a World in Distress. You can also go to suzannemoser.com, and that last name is spelled M-O-S-E-R. And I'd like to thank carolynbaker.net for introducing me to Suzanne's work. Suzanne, I did ask you the toughest questions, but only because you were brave and foolhardy enough to raise them, and I thank you for getting real with Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
We'll go back to Jerry Williams at the Occupy EPA protest in Washington, D.C.
So could you tell me, you're here from Occupy Lancaster.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what brought you here and different activities you're involved in Lancaster?
Well, early on, I guess the thing that got me involved first was the corporate personhood. I'm still pretty irritated about that. I realized the government was probably out of control, and it's under control by moneyed interests, we'll call them, and probably some of them are pretty close to here, K Street. The group I'm associated with, in addition to those concerns, I think they all feel that moneyed interests have taken over the country, and the man doesn't have a vote that works anymore. But they're also very interested in environmental concerns, and especially in Pennsylvania and fracking, because we're going to be drinking the water. Pennsylvania, and I'm no expert, but Pennsylvania's been raped once or twice before, and it's starting again.
Coal.
And lumber. They tell me lumber was first, and it was pretty impressive how they did that. And now the fracking has started, and I'm not that big of an expert, but I think it's going to be ugly. And I think the pollution is going to be significant, and I don't think they're going to repair their damage. That's been the history of what they've done up there, so we'll see. And a lot of the people that are with me, there's about 10 people here from Lancaster County today. They're certainly their main concern is fracking. But they know we've been sold out by the government.
My thanks to Jerry Williams in Washington, D.C., and to our guests, Dr. Helen Caldicott, Dr. Suzanne Moser, and Warren Karlenzig. This has been Radio EcoShock.